generally regard me as an awesome person.
Well,
this is well, my homesick home. Sitting on this beach, I see how much that you mean to me. My heart, it aches, about to break. And the thought that I can't shake is that look upon your face as we said one last goodbye. Tears fell from your sweet brown eyes. Tears for me? Through these tears, I see how strong our bond, even when you're gone and I alone. Kisses, lovemaking put on hold. We will get through this too, you and me, me and you. Thank you.
Have no fear of flames, eternal agony or death. A saint you may not be, but a work of art you are, breathing and pulsating and moving statue of David. Admire yourself and your sculptor. Examine the canvas of your soul as the colours mix within. Exhibit yourself to others at every opportunity, for you were created to be yourself, a masterpiece in the gallery of eternity.
Yeah.
Thank you, Damien. One quick announcement. Because tomorrow is St. Patrick's Day, it's a national day of festivities, the Long Valley Pub is opening half an hour later tonight. So we actually have the bar here until 12:30. So at any rate, could you tell us how long we can continue to order pubs at the time?
It's
25
past
12. So, very good news. Next up to the open mic is Peter.
Continuous look forward, postponing life in hope of the better tomorrow. The next fix, the next shallow thought, always some reason to avoid now, this second. Our hearts beat now, listen to the beat of this moment, no other. Hoping for better tomorrow is a dangerous thing. A magic prize at the end of this journey of struggle, I think not. Why delay this moment's happiness in pursuit of more in the next? To worry, wonder, dream of more. My friends, just relax. We have everything we need at any given moment. Stop the clock, look inside. It's all there for us. Us, just the way we are right now. That's it.
Thank you, Peter. Next up, Kevin Malay.
I wrote this poem. I was quite frustrated about how I wasn't very dedicated to much, and I can't really finish books very well. I kind of have revision issues. I always end up starting hobbies, don't continue them, and it's not too hard. So kind of about that, there's only kind of one constant I found, and time is being lost in the comments. So here we go. I cannot love being assembly of Christ, nor your elegant prose or your four-letter words made vibrant by your vibration of tongue. I owe no words to a morning that I love. For cloth and skin, I have no need for either. I'd like the soaring succulent words of tongue. I feed on the delicate curves of his upon his chin, stomach, and earth. But I cannot love being assembly of Christ. Your truth has weighed on me. I cannot love being a family price for you seduce so cleverly, sensuality, wet, holy water,
bruised, lost in the battle, and smelling of food, just for the extension. And as he locked his fingertips, I'm not a man of fiery things or passion. I'm a mere slave to the great air. I cannot love you, my family choice, nor your elegant clothes afford the safe word.
One more, smaller one. I wrote it on a trip home from Cork to Turtle, and I was on the train, and it stopped between Mallow and Plymouth Junction. And we were stuck there for 2 hours. The reason was apparent, which I don't know. But cow on the track. Frisian track marks. Trojan speed made head to you. Less meat to you. Sounds of sarcasm. The collision splits the coach. Those who last and those going to heaven. I saw them bless themselves. Puttered neighbour was retreating stubble, lumpy like dried beef. His agitation stank and stretched me out the lap. Free tea and coffee. Those who last were joyous. Secretly, so were the heavenly ones. Coffee, please. Milk with that, sir?
Thank you. Thank you, Kevin. Next up, Joe Sweeney.
From a kind of small book, and it takes the form of a series of letters from a teacher in a classroom to a principal, and the teacher's name is Maybe Gomo, and it's quite a difficult, challenging school, and in the last episode she was teaching in a prefab and she heard noises on the roof, and she went to investigate, and this is kind of a continuance of that. Dear Principal, 11:30. I am now in with 2A in room 19 on the upper floor in the main building. I have arrived late, but with an excellent alibi that can be corroborated, I would imagine, by half the school. When I arrived in class, it was just thunderous applause. This was because they had witnessed developments on the prefab roof during the last class. They were full of praise for the way I handled the situation. They were impressed with the agility that I displayed in avoiding the sweeping, slashing movements of Wolf Boy with the knife. Some of them suspected that I had taken up martial arts, so swift were my foot movements and defensive strategies. My skirt tended to get in the way a bit, though. I myself thought they added a kind of samurai feel to the whole performance. In fact, it was simply that I was shaking with nerves so violently that it lent a wild unpredictability to my movements and made me seem skillfully elusive to Wild Wolf Boy's lunges, when in short it was more terror than technique that was aiding me. All in all, it was a most dramatic confrontation. In fact, it was cinematic. Myself and Wolf Boy leaped around on the roof of the prefab in a duel of speed and nerve, which reminded some of the children, so they tell me, of scenes from Highlander, Star Wars, Terminator, and Gladiator. Well, I moved to the north, Wolfie moved to the south. I sidestepped eastwards while he went west, and so it continued for a while, the tension building with each move. Then Wolfie charged from the southeast, and I swiveled quickly north-northeast, and Wolfie's momentum, in addition to a little help from me, bang on the head with the duster, proved sufficient, and he disappeared over the side of the prefab. While at the time I was, as you can imagine, dear Principal, a bundle of nerves, I am now actually enjoying the adulation and popularity that this ill wind has blown my way. The affair ended quickly enough with Wolf Boy picking himself up out of the bushes into which he had fallen, I leaped down, full of confidence now, despite several tears in my nylons. He did attempt another rush at me with his knife, but I knocked his aside with a duster, and thus it was that, in a cloud of chalk dust from the blow I struck his head, he beat a hasty retreat down the school driveway, narrowly missing being knocked down by a police car, which comes on a daily visit to the school, whenever the officers feel like a little hot action. Though nerve-wracking, it was a new and challenging experience. It was admittedly an unexpected extension of my remit as a teacher, but is nonetheless something else to go on the CV. I was only sorry that you didn't glance out your window and see my performance. I know you would have been impressed. I think it would be fair to say that you would have been forced to admit that I am coming on by leaps and bounds. From an administrative point of view, however, I do feel that you should review school security to ensure that outside intruders cannot enter the school freely when they wish. There are enough strange people here already without letting any more in. Future incidents may not end so happily as the Wolf Boy episode, yours, etc. Maybe Gono teacher of French, English, and good manners, and martial artist. Dear Principal, this is the second to last letter, 1140. Things are fine here in 2A. They are a nice class. We have digressed from the curriculum on account of the day that's in it and are discussing the importance of self-defense in today's society and the wisdom of everyone doing some kind of martial arts training. Some of the children are standing up and giving impromptu demonstrations of the skills they have learned at their kung fu classes or witnessed in the movies, etc. And I am beginning to be alarmed. I think I may have created a monster. I hope none of them have learned how to smash wooden planks with their bare hands as beneath the desk for academic purposes. By the way, Principal, how is your nose? And the burns? Have they healed yet? I do hope so. I would hate to see you have to continue to go around like the Elephant Man for much longer. Wig still in place? Good, good. We'll write soon. The force be with you. Look out, Mr. Miyagi. Maeve is on the way. And P.S., do you think we could introduce martial arts into the curriculum at some stage? I would definitely be interested. You might even be interested yourself, particularly after that recent altercation you had, of which more anon in my next letter. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Goodbye, Ali from Cali. Next up is Wes Wallace.
Good evening. I come from a place called Providence, Rhode Island. And so, whoever was from California, hello. I know, it doesn't seem that much like a kinship when you're in America, but I've been reminded, tonight actually, and then I suppose in other times too, that I would be considered by some to be a blow-in. And in fact, wearing this exact sweater was the first time I really was confronted with that fact at a place called the Roaring Donkey in Cove. So people kind of gently told me that I wouldn't pass unnoticed wearing this thing. But I figured on this. On the eve of St. Patrick's Day, it seems like it ought to be that Irish people would just come out of the closet with their sweaters, but I guess that's not the case. Anyway, I have a little tale of the supernatural that comes from this pamphlet here, which I received from a physiotherapist in Cove. That's like a kind of a back doctor guy that a little bit somewhere between like a fake healer and a kind of a medical practitioner. It's interesting that this guy would have kind of tipped me on to the supernatural, because in fact, like, my presence in his clinic was due to a whole chain of circumstances, very unusual circumstances, and could maybe be considered in and of themselves kind of a part of another world that was kind of attempting to capture me. And I think, like, there are people talk about the supernatural or the paranormal. There's actually many different kinds of supernatural and paranormal. And that's reflected in the different words. People have, like, visions or ghosts or angels or poltergeists or epiphanies, maybe for the literary ones. But there are different kinds of access that we might have to different unusual ways of experiencing the world, and sometimes they can connect them to other unusual experiences. And here, this little ghost story. Now, this is a ghost story about Cork County that I'm going to just read to you. But how it came into my hands is there was an old family house that belonged to my family for about 100 years that was sold this past year, and a lot of problematic memories rose to the surface, and there was conflict, and there was kind of a grab, an attempt to grab different objects, and also to expel certain objects. Like, namely, there was a lot of objects left behind by a tenant, a man who had been renting this house, and he kind of left junk behind, and this junk was very heavy, and nobody wanted to take it out of the house. I eventually, with the help of a laborer, took the junk out of the house and dumped it. And from that, I got a bad back. And this bad back now has been plaguing me for a while, and I've seen various different therapists here in Ireland, varying degrees of alternative kind of qualifications. And in fact, it was while on my way to a therapist, to a physical therapist, that the cab driver who was taking me there told me about another physical therapist. And this other physical therapist was a fairly unusual man, and he started getting me to visualize green and to, you know, speak with crystals and things. And then he was suggesting that I undergo hypnotherapy with him as a hypnotherapist. And then he loaned me this book, this pamphlet, Ghosts of Cork. It's a commercially available publication. And I thought I would just check it out. And there are some unusual tales, some of which happen in Cove, actually. The very interesting one about the castle of Belvelly, if you ever have there. It's the castle with the first castle you see on your way is the Cove. But this one that I'm going to read here is, it's not about a castle, it's about an animal, and in particular a sheep. The story originates from the old cave near Mitchelstown, County Cork, which is sometimes called Desmond's Cave, after the Shugan Earl of Desmond, who took refuge there in 1601. In times past, there was a poor potato farmer who lived nearby, and one day as he was wandering through the fields, he suddenly heard the bleating of a sheep. This surprised him, as the sound appeared to be coming from a spot which wasn't suitable for grazing. He followed the sound and soon came upon a large hole, at the bottom of which was lying an ewe. An ewe is a female sheep. An ewe which apparently had broken her leg. Wasting no time, the man jumped into the hole and picked up the animal. On doing so, he suddenly became aware of how soft and white her wool was. And later, when he laid her safely on the grass, he had noticed how she had looked up at him with her big, beautiful eyes. The man carried the injured ewe back to his house, but kept clear of the main road for fear he would be seen. At first, his wife was under the impression that he had stolen the animal. But when he had told her of the strange way he had found it, she decided she would nurse the animal back to health. Up to this, her husband had planned on killing it. In time, with the woman's gentle care, the ewe got better, and they were fortunate in the sense that nobody ever came forward to claim it. The woman made stockings from the wool, and the garments were so soft that their fame spread throughout the countryside. As a result, the couple earned more money than they ever had done before. As time passed, the ewe produced a number of lambs, all of which inherited their mother's soft coat, and for many years the couple prospered. Then, with the approach of old age, the ewe lost her soft wool, and one night the man, despite his wife's pleas, vowed that he was going to kill the animal. However, the following morning, the couple were awakened by a young boy whom they had employed as a shepherd. He told them in a very excited manner that the entire flock had moved away, guided by the old ewe. The man, accompanied by the boy, followed the direction the sheep had taken. But when they came in sight of them, they saw the flock begin to vanish into the ground, one by one, before their eyes. The man, in a desperate effort to find the sheep, went through a crevice in some rocks in order to overtake them, as he still believed, on the other side. After a while, when he failed to emerge, the boy went to summon help. A search party of local men later followed the same crevice in the rocks where the man had gone, and it was then that they discovered the entrance to a cave. Obtaining candles from a nearby house, the group of men entered the cave, at which point they could hear a man's voice calling to his sheep. The men continued to search the cave, but could find no trace of the missing man. Neither he nor his sheep were ever seen again. Throughout the following years, it was believed that many people who ventured near the entrance of the cave after dark could hear the ghostly voice of the man calling his lost sheep. It was claimed, too, that the ewe was not an earthly animal, but a fairy creature, a belief encouraged by the animal's gentle disposition and the extraordinary quality of her wool.
Thank you, Wes. Next up is Seamus Harrington.
Pre-dawn, I'll return to spot stars on its flanks, Hippocrene shod, wings brushing through north. It's true about the baskets and these places. They're all very good in the summer, but this one is called Retreat. Soul's heavy mate waits his embrace, in search of grace at Waypoint Place. No weekend case or terminal lace, west gales to brace while the pulses race. But time to pace that meager space from peak to base, raw feet retrace, scan maker's face. On rocky chunk above seas dunk, no longer drunk as damask skunk. No steerage trunk or baubles gunk on Chinese junk, temptation sunk. Hirsute the hunk, in robes, pre-shrunk, no front door trunk, uneasy bunk, poor skelly monk. Post watch. Sandpipers wade by the blue lagoon. Charter boat skipper embarks his party. Guillemot gapes at the gannet's plunge. Windsurfers brace at harbour's mouth. Hang glider wheels around the Martello. Bird watcher zooms out over sound. Jet ski driver maintains her distance. Sheep dippers urge their hesitant flock. Ferry boat shuttles across the fairway. Crude oil tanker slips from her berth. Harbour pilot still meets his deadlines. Scuba divers glide out of their depth. Trimaran shows a clean pair of heels. Hardy Potter rounds his own Dan Boy. Dinghy sailors link in line abreast. Sea anglers reel at resounding echo. Half-deckers pace, ladies coxed fore. Coast guard rib recrosses her wake. Hill walker stops dead in her tracks. Abs sailors back down the broken cliff. Water safety school undergoes a tot. Deep sea trawler discharges her catch. All-weather lifeboat resumes her station. Life keepers absent forever and ever. God's Gable End. Lump hammers and chisels ring in the moonlight. Bold Norman commission removed in one chunk. Improper Monsignor shedding scant lichen should never be mounted on God's Gable End. Lugged to the causeway while crickets are rasping. Dumped in the seaway, don't utter a word. Oh no, gasped the mermaid, sheeling the gig. Shiver my lumbers, who are gain this? Friday evening. Spy glasses enlarge, lead lights reveal, compass concurs, surfers we board, harbour enfolds, winches recoil, rudders divert, seagulls gyrate, fenders defend, cargoes discharge, corners retail, topsides rehose, netting re-knots, sailors regale, forecasts absorb, galleys entice. Skippers equate, kettles proclaim, schooners decant, legends relate, deadlines discard, outboards retilt, dry glasses reduce, textures contact. Hunters pontoon, potters rebate, divers divest, shrimpers unpot, canoes recanute, ladies restroke, grapnels ungrapple, sheetings unpleat. Jet skis detest, circus loud hails, railings restrict, slipways congest, trailers uncouple, bylaws adhere, forklifts frequent, heron hijacks. Show-offs breaststroke, painters retouch, seacocks receive, ensigns referral, anglers escape, charcoals depict, sundries restash, poodles repedal, tankers refuel, tourists day trip, grey seals resnatch, flake eyes replenish, chandlers equip, bilge pumps regush, logs to update, yawnings recover, and finish off time. I'm just going outside, and maybe sometime. We glance at one another in dismay. Nobody speaks. Dry mouthed, I stare at the back door. In moments, our barman returns, rattling his bucket of ice. Thank you.
Thank you, Seamus. Next up is Dan Harding.
Her stringent standards reading, and it's a pity that she's not in the car. So I hope that she enjoys the rest of her stay being blown. She's talking about alienation, and this is about alienation for a friend of mine who couldn't face up to the fact that he drank too much and alienated all the people around him. It's called the devil's glass. I went desperate, slowly to the glass, with steady hand took it to my lips. The devil's glass at moment came to pass. The gates of hell invited me to cross and welcome me in my triple trips. I went desperate, slowly, to the glass. There was a cloud before my dreams to toss aside, but I ignore that cloud's tips. The devil's glass, his moment came to pass. Now I am in the grip and feel no loss, and savor all the dripping drips. I went desperate, slowly, to the glass. My boat is swirling round under duress. No light shines from other passing ships. The devil's glad my moment came to pass. The time has gone for me to come to grips, except for the glass that never slips. I went desperate slowly through the glass. The devil's glad our moment came to pass. Called Silence in the Garden. It's about the alienation of my parents and its ticket. My father hid behind the newspaper. His head was always full of words. Patient as an alligator, he knew the language of the world, but his house was dull. No angry words were ever hurled anywhere. My mother seldom saw his face from her chair, the pull of the garden too strong, her place being where the worms worked an endless shift of breeding life into soil. She spoke to them, they got her drift. Digging out a drill one day, her spade unearthed a little box dressed in foil, something worms could not invade. With hardened hands, she flicked across the boat. A thousand words erupted from within, words that gave her heart a jolt. He lowered the news, a glance beyond the sills, perhaps reflecting his silence for a sin. He saw her lying, one broad sheet between the drills. Thanks.
Thank you, Joel. Next up, Fiona. Just a short one on chicken and egg. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? The egg or the chicken? You can ask, or you can put both together in a sandwich. The beginning and the end, layered together, close, too close to comfort. Should there be some gap in between them, some stretch of existence, so I stick in a slice of tomato or anything like that. He's in a rear zone.
Right, an attempt to sum up all the world's wisdom in about, you know, 2.5 standards of culture. I might have said, okay, very good. True are the tales that from seeds do heads of lettuce grow, that it takes a page, a pen, and a poet to make a poem, that nothing is worth keeping which is easy in the finding, that wisdom is found in what was always known, that hard work is the remedy to hard luck, that patience is a virtue only if you have to wait for what is to come, that seeing is believing, that believing is hope, and that sight is worthless when measured against hope, that chance is not taken or all is regretted, that peace is not the absence of war, that courage is found most often without action, that affection is misery in someone's absence, that only labors of pleasure bear sweet fruit, that all victory is hollow and is claimed over your betters, that a good name unfairly taken is a good name waiting to be reclaimed, that gluttony is wanting what you already have, that past the age of flight you should never pick your nose, and that you are more likely to waste your life than embrace.
Thanks, Stephen. Christy.
Thanks for the contribution. Interruption. In introducing this poem myself, I have to say that I just want to make one special. Bear in mind, please, that. Just bear in mind when you hear this poem that it's not in Christmas. Yeah. I couldn't help but turn it up through the room when we found that the bar was open at 12. I couldn't help but notice the smokers outside blocking up the doorway on my way in. I couldn't help but see the rush through steps on the stairs as I descended myself. We all have our weaknesses, we all have our needs, we all have our, what's the word? Dependencies. This poem is called The Addict. It's about everybody. He was an alcoholic, drug-addicted, gambling addict with an over-reliance on food and a fetish for shoes. A religious zealot whose depressions were manic and an arsonist whose chain-smoking was old news. He had agoraphobia and was hooked on sex, and the kleptomaniac tendencies he could not avoid didn't help his long-term inferiority complex, which along with his hypochondria left him paranoid. One night, as his insomnia kept him awake and he struggled with his allergy to bed limit, he swore, despite being a compulsive liar, that for his mother's sake he would seek help and would suffer no more. Soon he was attending self-help meetings by the double, just like all of you. Every day and night he was part of some group or session that gathered in rooms anonymously and traded every trouble. He grew to love, spilling his soul to an audience of discretion. He cherished the camaraderie, love, and benevolence of people he adored. Life felt so good in these rooms of people on burning walls. His self-esteem was repeatedly restored and soared, and the joy of life filled his veins from head to toes. One by one, he beat his dependencies on alcohol, gambling, narcotics, depression, fear, fights, bouts of loathing, and smitting leather. His bulimia and nose-picking went to give his affinity for antibiotics. Nothing had ever beaten group therapy for making him feel better. Then one day, cut back. His nail-biting group was cut short. He felt faint. When everyone else had forgotten about the acute amnesia group, he cried. His nausea reminded him of when he first drank paint, when the necrophobia and treatment program he lived for also died. Whenever a precious gathering ended, he grew more agitated. Cold sweats and palpitations accompanied his angst-filled beatings that he was no longer able to discuss matters therapy-related. Then dawned the terrible truth. The terrible truth. He had become addicted to meetings. He began attending court cases to feed this new addiction. He showed up sweating at the funerals of people he never knew. He gate-crashed dressing rooms and inquests causing friction. He queued idly in post offices. Any troubled crowd would do. He joined picket lines and bus queues to further his kicks. He ran for council, hoping to feed monthly his tendencies. When he latched onto a rugby scrum for a quick but dangerous fix, he realized he needed rehabilitation for his unfortunate dependency. In desperation, he formed his own self-group. He
reformed reading anonymous, where people in dignity gatherings could be helped by staying away. Hundreds of addicts avoided every meeting. With every day became synonymous with helping people, not alone, and being unable to be alone every day. Within a year, he was able to cope with avoiding crowds. He was a man who could cope without anything, through the stimulation. Now he sits alone all day, staring out the window at the passing clouds. He hasn't yet admitted it, but he'd be lost without his daily meditation. And of course, the only, the best antidote and the best remedy and the best avoidance system of all for any kind of addiction is to stay where you are and stay in. Don't go out, don't meet anybody, don't indulge in anything, and you'll be there and you'll live happily and thankful. It's not a good thing. But this poem that the lead up to that is called The Opposite to Being Addicted. Perhaps I'm staying in. It's about me. I'm staying in tonight, it's just not worth the trouble. Too many pinpricks locked out here, I want to bust my bubble. Cartoonists taking risks with cards, kids of murder, fry pods, bookies getting crooked odds, bombers boarding airplanes, species going down the drains, doormen with more fat than brains, I think I'm staying in. Homeless people without choices, refugees not given voices, barmen asking rip-off prices, farmers feeding antibiotics, bus air and drivers, histrionics, golfers drunk on gin and tonics, I think I'm staying in. Farm workers underpaid, husbands making wives afraid, damp smoking banners being obeyed, mourners, groaners, drunken racers, courthouse full of local rapists, nuns who drive like great escapists, I think I'm staying in. Lads and puke beneath my feet, troubled lives sleep on the street, muggers trying to make ends meet, banks that fleece and threaten to, TDs hiding what they knew, budgies petrified of flu, I think I'm staying in. Hospitals with killer bugs, guardy bent, cutting plugs, greyhound trainers pushing drugs, Nance teams bent on pyramids, George Michael does what God forbids, Gaelic football scaring kids, I think I'm staying in. Zelotheel is always leaking, the health service forever creaking, the Pope and Paisley aren't speaking. Demented drivers overtaking, greenhouse gases emanating, priests and bishops fornicating, while everyone is fastidating, castigating, elucidating, investigating, gesticulating, adjudicating, instigating, delegating, insinuating, procrastinating, abbreviating, salivating, I think I'm staying in. Wait a minute. It's probably the tint with that looks and grin. I think I'm going out. You might end up in, I'm just going to bring this poem because it's close to my heart. I'm going to come down in y'all and Tesco used to open 24 hours, 7 days a week, 390 days a fucking year, if you ask me. Until recent times, then the recession came and they had to close down at 11 o'clock to everybody else. And this was where the consumerism, I suppose, took over our lives in the good old days, 6 months ago. It's called He Goes to Tesco's at Night When He's Lonely, and it's a love story. He goes to Tesco's at night when he's lonely and sad for the loads to get lost. A couple of miles walking up and down aisles gives him peace at a much reduced cost. His flat is quite warm and the decor has charm, and TV brings the choice of reality. But at 2 in the morning, the feeling starts dawning, he could do with a little humanity. The swift swath of heat warms his head to his feet as he enters the shop's twilight zone, and his large bag for life in the feet of a wife in his pattern of home and alone. There's enough light in Tesco's to fill a whole future, as it gleams like the sheen on the lard, and what heart doesn't thrill when the girl on the till inquires, "What's up, Cass?" There's chicken and yogurt and wine at half price, while pop tunes alleviate stress, with the tingling danger that an ask from some stranger might lead to a change of address. She liked shopping in Tesco's when she first came to town, when the days be like madness were true. But she found it less taxing and even relaxing to shop without having to queue. Reaching for the cream cheese, they left, "No, you have it, please." They blushed as they offered to share. He paid for the brie and she'd make the tea. So began the affair. Saturdays when the order as the romance was sealed, like a packet of newly smudged salmon. Soon they skipped down the aisle with the resonant smile that they used to reserve for fresh gammon. Alas for the marriage, its shelf life was short, like packets of wedding confetti. She favored loose spuds that were covered in mud, but he wanted rice or spaghetti. she started with muesli. He asked us for porridge. She said yogurt. He swore quite an arm. She loved mother's fried bread. He got Brennan's instead, and day after day it went on. She devoured her white pudding. He ate on his neck. She used persil. He swore by his own mouth. Kurt Cobain was the pride of her speedy rack when he picked up Kerry Coma. Over 18 short months, the love fell apart as the consumer wore took a toll. They couldn't even agree what tea it should be or what hand they should put in a rose. Then one day he heard she was shopping around, and the proof made him near suicidal as he followed her car to centre and spar with the marshal put up outside the island. Such utter betrayal was beyond the pale. He said, Castro, do not deserve that. It was mastered by Dave and unnuptials dead as he packed a collar of bags in the flat. He goes to Tesco's at night lonely and sad for the love he has lost. And a couple of miles walking up and down aisles remind him that love has a cost. Thank you.
Next up, we have Rob Earthmart.
I was well impressed with that. I was trying to add my own spin on that. My anger and frustration will lead to my self-devaluation, to degradation, lethargy, and sloth. By sitting, smoking, thinking, procrastinating, and drinking, I get to the place where I don't give a toss. And the only thing I've found to consistently make my world go round is work, practice, effort. Call it what you will, hey, and sometimes it's a bitter pill, but still, work, practice, effort leads to true relaxation instead of sitting about chewing off your fingernails in agitation. Work, practice, effort. I want to do one more. This is a true story. It's called Geography is Not My Strong Point. Nuclear Free Cork. Now there's a laugh. I met your man in the pub and he showed me the photographs. It seems in the early 90s we imported some scrap, offloaded at Hall Boland. The lads doing Irish Steel. This was before ISPAT. The lads took the scrap and he put it through the plant and he turned it into shiny new girders to satisfy the German's demand. The lads took the girders and he put them on a ship and he sent them off to Germany. It might have been Brest-Litovsk or maybe Hajduk-Split. As I said before, geography is not my strong point. Anyway, the lads washed their hands and they thought, job well done. So imagine their consternation when the girders were returned. It seems like the girders were well beyond the pale because the Germans' Geiger counter went right up off the scale. So what was the story? What was the score? The lads were really angry. There was a very nearly war, but there was one bookle there, a good old friend of mine, and he read them out an article over from the London Times. It seems that the bright sparks at Sellafield had knocked some buildings down, and he didn't even want all that radioactive scrap just lying around. So who was responsible? Who was to blame? Sellafield washed their hands of it. The management did the same. Leukemia and cancer cut a swathe through all the lads and nobody seemed to give a fit. So it's really very sad. And there's many a moonless, cloudless night but the harbour seems to glow and nobody knows the source of it. But it's not from the lights of Cove. Thanks.
Next up, Mary O'Connell. Very hard act to follow. This is a kind of play on words about what would happen if we tried to get rid of Greek and Latin words in English. Called Keep Your Panty On. People I know dislike the fact the classics hold such sway. They think the English language should be freed without delay from those Latinized constructions that most legal eagles use, preferring Anglo-Saxon words that go with swilling booze. When Bono learned about this plan to ruin the status quo, he convened an ad hoc meeting, as his name might have to go. The whole thing was sub judice, in camera as well, in case the vulgar multitude might hound you too to hell. But while they weighed the pros and cons, a quick vox pop was taken to see what could be salvaged if Latin was forsaken. The crux was that no matter how they talked ad infinitum, having English without Latin could never be an item. To make the Greeks eat humble pie would seem a paradox. Too many polyglots have flown out of Pandora's box. So those who want to extirpate all Greek and Roman roots are a bunch of oxymorons who got too big for their boots.
I had a friend once describe a certain type of personality as a conversation hostage, as in the person who traps you into a conversation won't let you go no matter the lack of your interest in what they had to say. They just wanted an object to talk at. And I've been thinking about this type of person or other types of people who just take from you as your object or body or something. And therefore, if I could keep this off the, my name off the mug, that would be great. You can, or take it off the... This has nothing to do with the young man I've been seeing with around here recently. It's nothing to do with him. It's the young man for him. It's
blackmail material.
Oh. Okay. Yes. I don't like the title, so I'm going to leave it off. He took my hand and took a bite from the flesh under my thumb. While chewing the fat, he told me how lonely he was and how filling I was. One finger stroked the curve of my ear, my spine softened in the heat. He lifted the lobe and nibbled it clean off. Blood trickled gently down his lips. What a good listener I was. Hungry for me, he made a dinner of me, tenderizing my flesh, rubbing warm, comforting spice into my skin. The last words he spoke to me, I'll never forget. Your soul is so beautiful, I could just eat you alive. Thank you. Thank you, Jennifer. Next up, Reed Buckley.
The place behind your eyes is somewhere I cannot go today. If only now we could sit in peace. You be the wife, I'll be the black key. The maid alarm box when you move has the unquestioned touch of lack upon shores. We will never talk about it. There is a chill in my bones today. A sea breeze of salt slices its way across blades of my shoulder. It is only the haunting of a phantom limb, seawater veins, the tone of voice of an invisible man, the startled tinkle of cutlery hitting the floor. We cannot even talk about it. In my mind, you turn in your bed today, offer the gift of your face to a woman in lace who can make you cry, where I only have power to induce a smile. Your kisses will cut across her canvas of neck. as he breathed the apple skin, your waist will surge over her. I will dust myself off and start again in a different key, black out the waist with the cave of my hand, hope that the tide will not reach me, and hope that it will. My song will be in minor. Thank you, Bruce. Next up, Gerald Heffernan.
Hello. I have a poem here which I wrote after I traveled to Eastern Europe and I met a friend, and I wrote this for my girlfriend. Well, I gave it to my other friend, but it was for the real friend. It's complicated. I don't expect anybody to... I'm reading this for myself, but it's called 131 Words. While in reverie, my eyes could not be seen, like the invisible nightingales on our balcony railing, they were fragile in the clouds, but looking below, breath goes back to the fall, to longing, to hung shoulders and clasped hands. One was in a glove, one naked, when we fought discernment between the green dust clouds, between beauty and mere embrace. A touch was certain, but only behind, hid in fog and indifference, with condensation fumbling until a crash, a crass question of motivation, growth form, steeped in Bourbon Joe and his merry Burger King, who made us eat, drink, and drink, like some turquoise magnetic force, twisting the poesis before the line, a grisly line, one which I had not met before, emerging from the fuzz and mist of a foreign cityscape.
Thank
you, Gerald. Next
up, Paul Casey. Very modest. I don't know if you do one long one or if like four short ones. The harp has always been my favorite instrument. I always said if I was given one when I was young, I would have held on to it and probably be playing it today. The Baruch harp. I first saw her sit amid the dust-stained light and clutter of a Norman castle hall, walked faceless through furnished ether to win her heart with a timid surrender. Filthy and proud, E and F strings of the high octave both missing, I ease her shoulder into mine, curve falls open, neck finds palm. A reflex catch of hands, circles their partner's waltz, first brushes the silver reins, cool nectar's breath from long parched willow depths, fingers widen, awaken arpeggio, eager to release a future and past interwoven. A lone giant shifts. The sweep of pillar flows beyond her faintly etched reaching arc along the clear rainbow of sounds to rest in pools of storms long gone where they tease the dance of time. This one I wrote yesterday. It's called The Speed of the Cat's Eyes. In his statuous sanctuary of mind, he has earned the right to listen to the quiet hum of cockpit, snug behind the stare of the world's sexiest feline. An eco-ship purrs silver smooth past shores of bastard amber stars to chase the veined twist of taillights
long spaces poised to a sudden rim. Earth's skin is spinning culture at more than the speed of sound around its center, around the sun, 67,000 miles per hour more. He turns up his thoughts in stereo. Lick the cream from these lips, honey. Seize movements from the passenger seat. A reason to steer with his knees. He stirs sugar into chamomile, skins up, scribbles a quatrain ending her hands, see. Her mirage smile flickers with pupils of dilated pearl. And okay, the program I've lost there in a C, so I'll just end with what I used to do. It's a delightful aftertaste. This river of kingly color, an ocular delight, this stream of purposy, a vein aortic mix of spirit liquid, as even evolved vampires overdose on blends of rich, thick contradictions, of unraveled breaths, expired, and even as muses, pilgrim seasoned muses, each leave a trail of purple dripping from tongue and teeth, a new harvest of mystery. And even as poets, starved poets, sip the mountain manna, purple flowing wine, dream drunk poets, pulse deafened, descend purply, their seasoned lips.